This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
To part four of this five-part series brought to you by Pop Goes the Classics here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. My name is Scott Criscolo, and again, this is part four of a five-part series chronicling one of the greatest movie franchises of all time, and that is, of course, the Bond, James Bond franchise. Probably, money-wise, I guess it's now number two, and that's only because of ticket money. I'll ask my co-host and my compadre this evening. Of course, he was the former purveyor of OpenTheFridge.net, and he has done an exceptional job in his Place to Be Nation Pop debut on the first three parts of this series. You people that simply get a nickname, he is Tech. Good evening. Good to have you back.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm excited we can keep this going.
Yes, it's been a great journey so far. So my question is, of James Bond, and I'm probably right in saying this, of James Bond and Harry Potter, I'm assuming Potter, of two movie franchises that were British-based or English-based, Potter probably has made more money, right? And that's only because, it may, even though it's less movies, ticket prices vary. I mean, if Dr. No was $12 a ticket, I'm sure, but even though there's been 24 Bond movies, I bet you it probably still has much more money than, of course, you know, Harry Potter's is only eight, but the Harry Potter run started in the era of $8-$9 tickets, where probably the first like 14 Bond movies, I don't think a ticket price broke $5 yet. So, I'm not quite sure. I'm sure my man here is,
you are correct,
researching that.
You are correct. Even though it was Potter fewer movies in a fewer amount of time, the Potter franchise has grossed more than the Bond franchise. If I'm reading this correctly, the Potter franchise has grossed $7.7 billion worldwide.
Wow.
And Bond, through his entire history, adjusted for inflation, $5.9 billion.
Okay. And again, we have to take into account that, you know, people were going to the movies, weren't going to the movies as much in the 60s. So, Dr. No and From Rush with Love and Thunderball probably, and, you know, Goldfinger didn't have as much in the way of people as it does now.
I think I mentioned this during the talk about Connery and Goldfinger. My mom has told me many times over the years that she just sat in the theater and watched Goldfinger on repeat. So I'm sure she paid for one ticket. And
my sister, you know, it's funny. I'm going to tell this story. I'm pretty sure I've told it on previous Pop Goes the Classics or Place to Be Nation Pop podcast. My sister, who's she's 11 years older than me, so she's in her late 50s. My sister was 16 when Grease came out in 1978. Well, she was so pumped for Grease that at the Capitol Theater in Milford, and to give you an idea, Tech, because he's a fellow Connecticutian like myself, you know where Stonebridge is?
I do not.
Okay. You know, all right. For those that are from Connecticut, and we have a few people like Glenn Butler and some others, the part of Milford, I'll explain to you later. Anyway, there was a Capitol Theater in Milford, which is no longer there. My sister and her best friend at the time went to the matinee. They took the day off from school. went to the matinee. Now, this is back when movie theaters were a little looser with their security. although you could probably do this now. I don't think they give a shit. Went to the matinee, went to the bathroom, went back in, saw the 2:30, went to the bathroom, went back, watched the five. They went to five viewings for one ticket.
I'm fairly certain you could still pull that off today.
Yeah, I think you can too.
Once you're through the ticket collector and in whatever wing of the theater you're in, you know, aside from the people who clean out the theater after reviewing, there's really nobody enforcing that you get the hell out.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that, sir. I think I'd have to agree with you on that. But in any event, my sister did that. So anyway, let's get down to brass tacks. Tonight, as mentioned, we are going through the next gentleman. Well, we kind of went out of order, but that's only because I wanted, you know, the others was a very short episode. So, of course, just to recap, if you're clicking on this one and you haven't listened to the first three yet, stop this one. Go back to placetobenation.com or go to the Place to Be Nation pop feed on any podcast catcher, whether it's Podbean or Apple Pods or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever, and listen to the first three. We did part one with Sean Connery. Part two was the others. We talked about the one George Lazenby and two Timothy Daltons. And then part three, of course, was Tex and my favorite Bond, the late Sir Roger Moore, who, by the way, is the only Bond actor to have passed away, not counting David Niven. Or Rowan Atkinson. No, that was Doctor Who. Never mind. I was going to say Rowan Atkinson, but no, he was Doctor Who.
Or Peter Sellers.
Yes. So tonight we are going to talk about the fourth guy to play Bond for more than two movies, and the only guy that was ever Irish that played James Bond. We are, of course, talking about, and he actually does have a excellent Order of the British Empire, so he is a sir, I guess, right?
Is he?
Is that what OBE means? Well, I know OBE means the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. But does that make him a sir? No, right?
Because he's not. That's not a knighthood. No,
that's not a knighthood. Because, well, he's not British anyway. We're of course talking about Pierce Brosnan, and Pierce, of course, has a lengthy behind-the-scenes history of the James Bond franchise before doing his first movie in 1995. So we'll go back in time. Of course, Pierce was an actor. He was very young. He was married to Cassandra Harris. He was on the set, and we kind of alluded to this in the last episode. He was on the set of For Your Eyes Only in 1980-81. And, you know, Cubby Broccoli and the gang looked at him and said, oh, he'd be a pretty good Bond. A little young right now, but maybe in like 5 or 6 years, he'd be a pretty good Bond. Fast forward. View to a Kill is done. Solid movie. Roger says, I look like shoe leather. I am done. I will not be a 57-year-old man in a shower with a 11-year-old girl, which is what Tanya Roberts looked like. So Roger was done. The decade of decadence, or over a decade, 7 movies in 12 years, is over. And I remember being pretty devastated as a kid because I love Roger. So the search was on for a new Bond. Well, they went back in time and looked back to 1980-81 and said, wow, you know, remember that guy, that Irish guy? Oh, yeah, Pierce Brosnan. But isn't he doing a TV show? Well, for those that were 80s kids, you remember the show Remington Steele, solid spy show. He was in it, of course. The show was off the air. I think 4 seasons in, NBC decided not to renew. I think the 4th season's ratings were a little saggy. So they were gone. Well, Pierce Brosnan is looked at by the brass for the next Bond, which would, of course, be the Living Daylights, and he was in. Now, it was kept under wraps because apparently, and I think it's – correct me if I'm wrong, Tech. I think I have the number right. NBC supposedly had 60 days to decide if they were going to pull the trigger on a 5th season of Remington Steele. Now, again, the 4th season sucked. Was not that great, so the show had pretty much run its course at this point. And I don't think NBC knew anything about it. So the clock ticked, the X's were on the calendar, day 59 it goes, and everything's great. On day 60, his agent says everything's great, something's happening, we're all good, we're about to pull the trigger, and I don't know if somebody spilled it, thumb screws, Chinese water torture, waterboarding, I don't know. But somehow NBC found out and said, oh, fuck this shit, and pulled the trigger on the clause, and poor Pierce had to tell Mr. Broccoli, oops, and had to go back. and do a fifth season.
It was crazy because it was kind of like a snake eating its tail, because the show, as you said, the show was on its decline. And because Brosnan's name was brought up to be the next Bond, that publicity got Remington Steele back into like the public eye or public attention. And that's what prompted them to renew it at the 11th hour.
Meanwhile, I think my dad watched the show, and I remember my dad saying that the fifth season was pretty horrible. Number one, because it, you know, it had run its course, obviously. NBC was just looking to cash grab. But B, look, if you're a writer, think about, my friend, all the years of The Doctor and switching over from doctors and then not knowing what the hell's going on, like when it went from Peter to Colin Baker and then his seasons were all up in limbo and shit was going on and you're writing shit quickly and what the hell. And I'm sure that same thing happened. I'm sure the writers of that show were like, well, I thought we were done. And those episodes were a perfect example. You and I had this conversation. Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
Justice League. Unlimited. They were – was it JL or the JLU?
They did two seasons of Justice League. Then they moved on to Justice League Unlimited, Bruce Timm and company on Cartoon Network. And they told this great story with Justice League Unlimited, and they ended it. They even produced an episode called Epilogue, which was a jump ahead. More on that in another podcast, I'm sure. And then Cartoon Network said, this was great. We want to give you guys another season. And they all looked at each other and went, we kind of shot our load there.
And I'm assuming that's exactly how what happened here, I would think.
You know? It's also what happened to Babylon 5. It's why the 15th season of Babylon 5 is terrible.
Yes. Another great show. Well, let's talk about that down the line. So Pierce did the fifth season of Remington Steele. And of course, Cubby and the gang had to get Timothy Dalton, who, and we talked, we won't belabor it on the others, but he did a pretty good job with The Living Daylights and a fairly horrendous job with License to Kill. Of course, that movie in general sucked, regardless of Timothy's performance, other than Robert Davi Benicio del Toro is so 50-50 because he was so young, you know, I mean, so I'm not going to yell at him or give him credit. He was just kind of there, but he was solid. But Robert Davi kicks ass, but the rest of the acting in that movie's bad. The plot's bad. Just everything about that movie's terrible. While that movie tanked, Cubby was having issues with the bank. Not that anybody was broke, but this was mostly transfer of funds and United Artists and a bunch of gobbledygook and tomfoolery and stuff that way over techs in my pay grade. So Bond, for the first time since the Cubby-Saltzman split, went on an extended hiatus, the longest hiatus in franchise history, 6 long years. And in the early 90s, and correct me if I'm wrong, sir, and I was in college, so stuff in my life was going kind of kooky, different things. Bond left my consciousness, mostly because I hated License to Kill so much, and another great movie came out that year. What are you? I'm Batman. I was all in on that, and Bond kind of left my consciousness for a little bit, and I was all in on Michael Keaton and Jack and the gang, and I was all comic booked up. So Bond left me at that time. So I had no thinking in the early 90s about Bond. I thought the franchise was done. You're not going to get a better Bond. Where's Sean? Where's Roger? This is crap. That was my thinking, and my family's thinking too. Now, you're what, 7 or 8 years younger than me? So at this time in the early 90s, you were kind of, what were your thoughts about it at that point?
Well, at the point where I was, you know, starting to, of the age to start to watch Bond, it was just essentially what was on TV, whatever TBS would run, 7 days of 007, which is exactly how I saw my first, movie, which was Moonraker, and then my second, which was Goldfinger, and so on and so forth. And I mean, I honestly couldn't tell you what year that was. Because it's just kind of in my memory as happening, and that's about it. By the time GoldenEye had come out, I wasn't like a full-blown Bond fan who was, ready to go to the movie theater and see it. In fact, the first Bond film I saw in the theater was World Is Not Enough. Mm-hmm. So, but we'll get to that one. So at this point, like, I wasn't antsy for a return or excited that, it was finally coming back, which I have a regret about that, because I totally wish I was, because the teaser trailer for GoldenEye is one of my absolute favorite movie trailers of all time, because of how subtle it is, how it just opens with music and text, and the music is just this beautifully again, subtle version of the Bond theme that remember at the time when you saw a movie trailer for the first time in an actual movie theater?
Yes.
I wish that I could have been in a theater and seen that for the first time, not knowing it was coming, because I'm sure it would have just blown me away, you know, being the Bond fan that I am now, hearing that music going, wait, what? And of course it culminates, well, the opening culminates with Brosnan walking into the light and, you know, smiling at the camera and saying, you were expecting someone else. So it was, yeah, the return, of, so to speak.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So, but before we get to that, though, again, we're going through a dark time. There's money issues. There's creative issues. And it was also about this time that Cubby started getting sick. So in the early 90s, things were not great. To be specific, while Brosnan was reluctant to discuss losing the Bond role, in part because Dalton was a friend, he appeared in Diet Coke commercials portraying what the LA Times described as a dashing Bond-like character. And NBC advertised Noble House with Brosnan dressed in a Bond-like tuxedo. Legal disputes between the Bond producers and the studio over distribution rights, there was the problem, resulted in the cancellation of a proposed third Dalton film in 1991, which I would have probably blown my brains out if I had to watch that, because God only knows how much. Although, let's think about that for 2 seconds before we move on. License to Kill is so unbelievably bad. Do you think they could have rebounded from that at all? Or do you think 1991 would have been another stinker? Kind of put your Karnak hat on. What do you think?
I think the precedent had been set that it would have. Because there had been, I think we discussed this in the Roger Moore episode, the pendulum swings every now and then in the history of the Bond franchise. And after, I mean, the more egregious examples are later in the series. But, you know, every time they kind of get ahead of themselves and things, you know, get a little silly, they manage to bounce back. And financially, up to this point, I think the best example is Golden Gun to Spy Who Loved Me.
Correct.
So I absolutely think had they really had the chance to hunker down, you know, without all this stuff looming over them, you know, the pit and the pendulum metaphor notwithstanding, I think they could have pulled something out. And there's very limited information about what it was going to be. I think the only thing I've ever seen is a list of locations where the movie would have taken place and the MacGuffin having to do with like nanotechnology or something. That's about all I've ever seen about the proposed third Dalton Bond movie.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, maybe we could have crossed our fingers and maybe something could have happened. But in any event, because of all that stuff and crap was going down, after the legal issues had been resolved, Timothy Dalton said, "I ain't waiting any longer, so go pound sand." And then I wouldn't see Timothy Dalton again. I don't know when you would see him again. I definitely didn't see him again until he was on Gallifrey.
Oh, The Rocketeer, man. 1991.
Oh, shit. I totally forgot about that. I gotta see that again. You know what? You and I may need to do a pop. I think you and I have to do a Pop Goes the Classics for The Rocketeer.
Count me in. That is one of my favorite movies. Say what you will.
On Disney
absolutely.
Plus, right?
It sure is.
It's on Plus. Okay.
Absolutely. 1991. He's the villain.
So he went from a third Bond film to The Rocketeer. Okay. He didn't do too bad.
Playing an Errol Flynn as a Nazi analog.
Yes.
Spoiler alert. <funny. laughs>
In any event, he would come back more in the main, you know, he'd be in that and then he kind of bounce around and then I would eventually really remember him with, David, with the 10th Doctor, as the kind of the head Time Lord of, Gallifrey on Doctor Who in the late 2000s, early 2010s.
Yeah, he popped up on TV for a good year. He was on Chuck for a while, the NBC show.
Was he really? Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't watch Chuck.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me go back.
Oh, give Chuck a watch. That's a fun one.
Yeah, let me find.
And he was also, I just got to say this, he was in a highly underrated comedy, The Beautician and the Beast. Him and Fran Drescher. I have a soft spot for that movie. I think it's very funny.
He was married to, I didn't realize this, he was married to Vanessa Redgrave for 15 years. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
1971 to 1986, he wasn't married for 9 years, and then in 1995 he married Oksana Grigoreva, and then he divorced her in 2003. Or somebody divorced. I don't know which of those. All right, I'm going to look
and
at
now
his...
he's Mr. Prickle Pants in Toy Story.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to... All right, Timothy Dalton on stage and screen. Okay. So here's what he did on the big screen. Let me see. Let me do this. Let me go to television and see when he's... When is he on Doctor Who? He is on Doctor Who in 2009, 2010. He's, of course, Rassilon. He is the Lord President of the Time Lord. So we'll say 2009. So because he's at the tail end of David's run. I'm sure we'll have plenty of Doctor Who talk here as well down the line. All right. So now I knew him as Prince Baron in Flash Gordon because that
movie
kicks ass and takes fucking names. That's another one you and I will do. Andy's going to get pissed. I'm going to take all the good movies. Anyway, so here's what he did between License to Kill and 2009 when he was Rassilon. All right. So here's the movies. The King's Whore. That's a dandy. I wonder if that was the next Bond film. The Rocketeer, Naked in New York, Saltwater Moose, The Beautician and the Beast, The Informant, Made Men, The Reef. I remember The Reef. Cleopatra. He was Caesar in that. Timeshare, Possessed, American Outlaws, Looney Tunes Back in Action, Tales from Earthsea. Oh, he was in Hot Fuzz. That's right. He was in Hot Fuzz.
Oh, how did I forget that?
He was Simon Skinner in Hot Fuzz. That's right. I forgot about that. And then he makes his debut as Mr. Prickle Pants in Toy Story 3. All right. On TV, since License to Kill, he was in an episode of Tales from the Crypt. He was on an episode of Framed. Scarlet, which was a miniseries in 1994. Stories from My Childhood, ESU, Emergency, that was a narrator. Cleopatra, oh, that must have been a TV and miniseries. Dunkirk, which was a documentary in 2004. Hercules, Agatha Christie's Marple, and Unknown Sender, If You're Seeing This Tape, which was a Strike.tv. And then, again, in 2009, 2010, he was Rassilon. So Timothy Dalton was busy. So I will say that. I didn't say he wasn't busy. I just remember him in specific things. To be fair,
the movies you listed up, not a lot of those are really high-profile titles recall.
Yeah, not. Well, like I said, he was busy. I didn't say they were very good.
Yeah.
He was busy. So anyway, so after his third movie is canceled, TD says, I'm done. So when they get rid of the legal wrangling over distribution and deal with United Artists crap and everything, it's time to get a new Bond and get back on the horse. Well, this one was easy. 1994, Pierce Brosnan's doing, let's see what he did after Remington Steele while he had to wait around. Here we go. Oh, good. His filmography's easy here. Okay. He was in The Deceivers, The Heist, which is a television film, Mr. Johnson, Murder 101 television film, a lot of TV films. He was in The Lawnmower Man. I don't remember.
He sure was.
He's in Livewire. Of course, he was the douche new beau in Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yep. 2 years before Bond.
Yep. And Entangled. And he was in a TV film called Broken Chain. He was in Love Affair. He was also in Don't Talk to Strangers. But at that point, they go back to him. And he's in. So on August 7th, 1994, June 7th, 1994, 6 days after my 21st birthday, Pierce Brosnan got what he wanted. 8 years after not getting it, he is Bond, James Bond. I remember people cackling a little. My brother, my sister, my brother going, really? Remington Steele is James Bond? I'm like, why not? I'm sure in 1972, people were like, the Saint is James Bond. And in 1961, people went, Darby O'Gill is James Bond. So, you know what? Everybody deserves a shot.
He wasn't Darby O'Gill.
No, he wasn't. I know. He certainly wasn't one of the little people either.
No.
Another
precedent. Absolutely. Roger, did his stint on, a spy show, more or less, to boil it down. Why wouldn't this be, an acceptable thing?
So we dive in. And we get going on the first movie. Now, again, things have changed in the Eon production family. As mentioned, Michael Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, Cubby's daughter, and Michael's was his stepson. They're pretty much calling the shots at this point. Cubby is in his 80s. He's battling cancer. So So they're the ones calling the shots now. So now, for the first time in the franchise's history, Cubby is not directing the ship. So what do we get for the first Bond outing? Well, we get a movie that, would I call it safe? Yes. Was it smart to play it safe? Yes. Tech mentioned it. We get the first Bond film in 6 years, GoldenEye, which is a tremendous title. Of course, everyone who's in the know knows what GoldenEye is. GoldenEye, of course, was the name of Ian Fleming's little property, his oasis on the island of Jamaica. GoldenEye was not a book. At least I don't think it was. No.
It was an actual naval operation he participated in.
Yes, that too.
And which he then named, his Jamaican estate. And then they then named the movie.
We're pretty much past the titles, right?
There's like the four that are still languishing to this day.
Right.
But yeah, at this point, they just started going original in terms of content and titles.
Right. So GoldenEye, we reintroduce Bond. We keep the canon going. We're not, doing new things or anything. The poster was awesome. I was excited. I was excited again. Martin Campbell was producing.
Directing.
Other than Pierce, see, the things that I was excited about was not just the new Bond, but we have to fill all the other roles. We knew that Desmond Llewellyn was coming back because he was still kicking pretty strong. So Q was back. But Robert Brown, far as I know, was not planning on coming back as M. We needed a new Miss Moneypenny. So those were the things I was excited about, actually, who was going to fill those roles. Well, as I mentioned, Desmond Llewellyn was returning. Moneypenny would be played by Samantha Bond. Har, har, har. And she's very, very pretty. I think that was a good choice. And she ended up being a pretty good foil. She had that Lois Maxwell level of snarkery, right? I think she held her own.
I would actually set her apart because I mean Lois is obviously the standard, who occasionally would make eyes at Bond, to the point where she got so desperate that, shortly after his wife was murdered, she wants him to bring her a diamond ring back from, Holland. But
that's true.
And then Carolyn Bliss, she's just throwing herself at Dalton.
Yeah.
Come over and listen to my Barry Manilow collection. Samantha Bond is the first one who really, like, her first scene, he comes in, he's going to see him, she's there in the office, and she's kind of, giving him some shit. He says she's all dolled up, and he's like, "Oh, I've never seen you after hours. What are you up to?" She's like, "Believe it or not, I have a date. I do have a life outside of this 007."
I'm
like,
I know.
"Oh, wow, she's throwing some sass at him, and it's great. It's a wonderful, refreshing take on the character. I think. Sadly, her role kind of went back to basics as her tenure went on, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. And it also, I think we also have to take into account, and we mentioned this in the Roger episode, that with the times, things changed. And we're about to say that right now, because for the first time in franchise history, M is a woman.
Yep.
That was actually a bigger deal than anybody who was going to be Bond.
Not just anyone.
No.
Dame Judi Dench.
Yes. Dame Judi Dench. And Judy would be M for the next 17 years.
Yeah.
And
eight movies,
17 years. And she was tremendous.
Well, seven in a cameo.
Yeah. She was awesome and she gets better and better. She takes no bullshit from anybody. The conversation when they're in the, let me do the rest of the cast and we'll get to that point. Who's our villain? Another tremendous actor. He always plays a good bad guy, and he would continue playing a good bad guy throughout time. Sean Bean plays Alec Trevelyan.
So great.
006, who turns heel, and then 9 years later is calling the shots of a crime syndicate. Isabella Scorupco is the programmer, and she ends up being Bond's, the Bond girl. She was okay. Little soft, but she was okay. We go back to the awesome double entendre names with the great Xenia Onatopp, played tremendously by Famke Janssen. Janssen. She is a, and I love the way they put it here on Wiki, she is a sadistic lust murderer. What a tremendous way to, of putting that. Because, of course, as you remember, she tortured her enemies by crushing them between her thighs. Yeah. Yum. So.
Yeah, she did. She always did enjoy a good squeeze.
Yes. You know who we don't have, Tech?
We don't have Felix Leiter.
We do not have Felix Leiter. Who do we have?
We have Jack Wade, played by the inimitable Joe Don Baker.
Oh, it's tremendous.
Returning to the Bond franchise.
Yes. The only guy of those 2 years of Dalton where they went, you know, we could use him again. Not the rest of this crap. But we could use him again. Except now he's a good guy. And he's important. The other thing is, though, is unlike, I think we can comfortably say this throughout Pierce's run, more people help him than just one guy. Because we'll get a character that crosses over between both the Bond and Harry Potter franchises. You know who I'm talking about. He's not in this one. Oh, yes, he is in this one. And we'll see him again down the line. We are, of course, talking about Valentin Dmitrievich Zukovsky. And that is, of course, played by Hagrid himself, Robbie Coltrane.
He's so great.
He is tremendous.
Just in general, Coltrane is great.
Oh, he is. He's absolutely tremendous. And as mentioned, he will bounce back. He'll pop in and out over the next four movies. So a quick go through. Bond fights to prevent an ex-MI6 agent going rogue, becomes a mob boss in essence, from using a satellite weapon against London to cause a global financial meltdown. So here's the thing. And we're now going to talk about one of the most important scenes that a Bond franchise would ever have to this point. It's the scene where Pierce, 007, after he does his byplay with the psychologist in the car, goes into M's office, and M pretty much tells him, this isn't the old days where you could sit here, drink scotch, whack asses, and go get me coffee, Moneypenny, while you're attacking the Russians and the Chinese and every other communist. Times have changed now. The Cold War is over.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I was just about to say
that. Yeah, the Cold War is over. And in the immortal words of Judy, James Bond is a, quote, you remember?
Misogynist dinosaur.
Correct.
Relic of the Cold War.
Relic of the Cold War. So we are told literally, 15 minutes in, that the Bonds that our parents liked are gone.
Yes, this is literally the Bond of the 90s.
Yes, we need new. We're not quite attacking the Middle East yet. We're not, you know, our villains are not. I mean, we kind of touched on it during the Dalton years, but, you know, the we don't have, you know, Iraq or whatever, Afghanistan or, you know, Middle Eastern terrorist kind of things.
Bond isn't going after Saddam Hussein.
No, not at all. No. So they have this nice original story where a Bond guy, and it's not the last time we'll have that, because the next guy that plays Bond has a similar movie, which is better than this, which speaks volumes of that movie, because this movie is very good. And so Sean Bean turns heel, creates Janice, and wants to have a global financial meltdown. I really like this movie. And Bond and Pierce, who said on the documentary he was nervous delivering the line, but he delivered it perfectly fine in the casino, because that line should be delivered in a casino. Because it's just the way it feels. Again, you could say that this story was safe to start a new Bond off, but I think the movie's great. I think the story is good. I think the casting was, for the most part, pretty solid. Top to bottom, tremendous film.
I love GoldenEye. This movie, to me, this is almost a perfect movie. The glaring blemish on it is the score by Eric Serra. I mean, we had decades of, you know, John Barry and, you know, a handful of others, Marvin Hamlisch and Bill Conti. And while they all kind of put their spin on it, it was all fairly consistent.
George Martin.
Marvin Hamlisch at this point was probably the only one who really, really took a chance. Eric Serra's score to this movie is ridiculous. It just sounds like a bunch of people slamming like beams against steel pipes.
Yeah, it was not good.
To the point where during the big action scene with the tank in the streets of St. Petersburg, where he actually blasts out a John Barry-esque, you know, brass, you know, piece of music, it's almost surprising. Like, oh, well, this is what it should be, but this isn't what it has been up to this point or what it is after it. So that's really my only gripe with this whole movie. But beginning to end, I love it. I love how it opens. It's a fantastic cold open. You know, it's, you know, one of the first times you really get to see Bond working with another 00. You know, it is post Cold War, but we're dealing with, you know, Russians, you know, because there totally were Russians out there who just were holding on to, you know, the Soviet Union mentality and all that. I like Wade. I know he's, you know, just kind of a placeholder for Felix Leiter at this point, but say what you will about Joe Don Baker, I think he's very funny in his, you know, limited time on screen. As you said, Isabella Scorupco, she's all right. She's fairly forgettable. You know, they tried to make, you know, a modern woman into a Bond girl. They tried, you know, oh, she's a computer programmer. She's important. She's intelligent. And that's great. It just, they didn't really follow through with it because she still ends up being the damsel in distress at the end of the movie.
Correct.
Xenia is wonderfully sadistic. Famke gives that, amazing. She gives that her all. It's absolutely wonderful. Robbie Coltrane, an absolute delight. Again, hilarious in his delivery. And Sean Bean. I challenge anyone to say anything bad about Sean Bean in anything. I love Sean Bean. He's so great. He's, you know, and it's cool to see, again, spoiler alert. I mean, if you're listening to this, you've probably seen the movie. But, you know, yeah, he's a 00 turned villain, which is a great, great idea. You know, it's right up there with the, sadly, the never fulfilled promise that Sean Connery would one day, you know, become a Bond villain. It's a whole nother conversation. But to see a 00 be the bad guy, very awesome. And the last thing I'll say, I really like the song in this movie. I really like the Tina Turner song. Yes, it's written by Bono and the Edge. I'm not the biggest U2 fan, but whatever. I love the song. I think it's very of the time. And it's just a cool song.
I have zero problems with the song. No, zero. I had an interesting conversation with my mom about this yesterday. I found a playlist on Apple Music and we were driving around and we were playing all of them. And cause I wanted her to play, I didn't want her, I was tempted to have her listen to the new song, the Billie Eilish song, but I'm like, nah, I think I'll wait. I played her various songs. I just played them down and this came on and she goes, "Ah, this isn't bad. I like it. I like you. I like it." But it would probably be the only Pierce song that would be worth any oxygen to this point. So it did pretty well. $60 million budget and I lost my page here. It made, let's see, between $352 and $356 million. And it opened at number one at the box office. So no problems there. Perfectly fine. So Bond is back. Unfortunately, between GoldenEye and our next film, the saddest day in Eon Productions history had finally happened. On June 27th, 1996, at the age of 87, Albert Cubby Broccoli passed away from cancer. There is a great moment, and this warmed my heart because I thought I didn't really remember this at the time, but yes. Sean and Cubby did make amends at the end. As a matter of fact, Sean called Barbara, or Dana, his wife, one of the two. It's on Everything or Nothing. And he said, "How is he?" He goes, he's close. He needs you. And I almost broke down at this point. And Sean and Cubby talked, and they said they loved each other. That made me feel good. I didn't like – I'm one of those ones, and Tech knows me very well, I hate non-happy endings. I'm a very traditionalist when it comes to movies, TV. I want a happy ending. That was a happy ending. Cubby could go off to in peace to the next world, knowing that he made amends with his first big star. So I think Sean felt good about that at the end too. So Cubby's gone, and now it is official that Michael and Barbara are calling the shots now. And that brings us to our next Bond film, 1997's Tomorrow Never Dies.
Before we do that, I would just like to,
of course,
stay on GoldenEye for just one more second, because even though GoldenEye came out in 95, and yes, Tomorrow Never Dies hits theaters in 97, just prior to that, it came out in December, in August of 97, GoldenEye 64 came out.
Yes, we need to talk about this. I am so excited you brought this up.
Yes, and we would be remiss not to mention it.
No, we were remiss. You were absolutely right. My apologies. I was going to kind of bring it up at the end, but I'm glad you brought it up now. Pierce Brosnan would probably be the most used Bond in media history, because not only is he in four movies, but he's in like five games, I think, too, amongst other stuff. And GoldenEye for the 64 is one of those. He also, The World Is Not Enough had a game. James Bond 007 Nightfire, and of course, Everything or Nothing. So, which of course would be the documentary. So he was in four movies and four video games. Not bad. Trivia question. Ready for this? We know that Cassandra Harris was his wife when he met. They married in 1980. Of course, she's another one who passed away of cancer, sadly, in 1991. In 2001, and I didn't know this at all, his wife, you know, he married, and he's married to her now, Keeley Shea Smith, who ended up co-hosting Unsolved Mysteries at the end of Robert Stack's run. I didn't know.
Really?
I knew that, but I didn't know that was Pierce Brosnan's second wife. I had no idea. Kind of cool. Anyway, so 2 years later, when was our release date? December 19th, 1997, we get our second Pierce Brosnan Bond film, Tomorrow Never Dies. Roger Spottiswoode directs. And again, this is the first Bond film where Michael and Barbara are firmly in control. Cubby has departed to the next world, God rest his soul, and they're calling the shots now. And let's just say that they had some hits, but they most definitely had some misses. The hits. Roger Spottiswoode, great, good director, solid job. What do you think of David Arnold's score?
Second Coming of John Barry. It is absolutely what the franchise needed. I regret that he did not get the score GoldenEye. Like I said, Eric Serra was just a blip and a blemish on that movie, on the franchise as a whole. David Arnold brings in that Barry brass, that bombastic sound, while adding, you know, his own spin. Hell, there's a track in this movie where he uses, I swear to God, it's scissors as a percussion instrument, because that's exactly what it sounds like, and it works. Like, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I forget what track it is. David Arnold is fantastic. He did what, five movies in a row, and I was sad to see him, you know, not come back to the franchise with Skyfall. We'll get to Skyfall. Skyfall score is fine, but I miss David Arnold as a Bond composer.
Among the other things he scored Stargate, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He scored Independence Day.
Yeah, he's Roland Emmerich's guy.
He scored Godzilla, and no, not that one.
Again.
Yep. He also scored, he scored the series Good Omens.
He did.
Yeah, he did. I love that show.
He also scored Sherlock.
Yes,
I love his theme and his music to Sherlock. If you ever watched Sherlock, folks, watch Sherlock. Benedict Cumberbatch, Martin Freeman, fantastic.
Yes, I agree 100%. You're exactly right. He also did four John Singleton films, too. So he's 58, and he's still kicking ass. All right, so the premise of Tomorrow Never Dies, Bond attempts to stop Elliot Carver, a power-mad media mogul, from engineering world events to initiate World War III. I know a lot of people think that plot sucked, but I will fight in an alley with a 2x4 for this one, for one reason. As tech knows, I was in the business, and as most of you who've listened to our shows for years know, I was in the business. I was a radio guy, in radio news for 11 years. So I have a soft spot for news and media and that kind of thing. So Elliot Carver was a cool bad guy. Simplistic premise, but you know what? Fuck it. Make a simplistic premise if you have good actors working it. That's what I say. And Jonathan Pryce is so good. So good.
Absolutely.
He's so good.
It was the return of the like megalomaniacal Bond villain, which we hadn't really seen since, I guess, Zorin, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, the two Daltons were nothing like that. They were like multiple bad guys. And then, you know, Franz Sanchez was a drug dealer, so he wasn't really a megalomaniac. And then obviously, as we just said, Trevelyan was not a Drax or a Stromberg. He was just, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, yeah, Jonathan Pryce, I mean, he's delightfully over the top in this movie.
Yes. No, he is. He's really good.
There's no news like bad news.
God, I love him. He's great. Joe Don Baker's back as Jack Wade. Judy's back, etc. Okay. This is the first Bond film where maybe the one thing that Barbara and Michael needed to work on was the casting. Because for the second time in the last three Bond films, the female choices were suspect at best. I like Michelle Yeoh. I don't love Michelle Yeoh. I like her better now on Discovery. I think she's awesome now. But she was not my favorite pick in that slot. Obviously, they wanted someone of Asian descent because that's where a majority of the movie took place. She was okay. She wasn't great. She's okay. What'd you think of her?
Michelle Yeoh, I think it was the second try at what they attempted to do with Natalia, Isabella Scorco in Goldeneye. You know, let's present, you know, a capable Bond girl, you know, a female lead. And it's great. She rises above the Natalia character because she's an actual agent. She works for the Chinese Secret Service. So she's holding her own for a good chunk of this movie. But again, it all just comes to a screeching halt at the end because she's, once again, just the damsel in distress. She's literally captured and tied up at the end of the movie while Bond dispatches everybody. But all in all, I like her. There are moments where her performance is a little suspect. Like she's a little flat, a little stilted. Mm-hmm. I don't know what her, you know, English speaking film pedigree was up to that point. You know, if it was early, you know, I'll give her a pass on that one. But all in all, I think she's fine. It's the other one that kind of I think we both have issues with.
Yeah, well, we'll get there. Yes, and we're about to say that now. So, in the midst of her doing, because I'm pretty sure she was right in the middle of doing The Adventures of Lois and Clark.
It had ended the summer before this movie came out.
Okay,
so she was right off of that.
Right off of that, we are of course talking about one of the most controversial casting choices in Bond history, up par with another casting choice we'll talk about in the next film in a few minutes. We are talking, of course, about Terry Hatcher. She's only in this movie. She's only in half the movie. She ends up getting bumped off.
Barely.
Yeah. She's awful. She's lazy. Her lines are bleh. She apparently was a bitch on set. Michael and Barbara dropped the ball on this one. I don't think once Cubby probably saw how she acted, he would have no business putting her in this movie. Yeah, but they thought maybe they wanted to cross over from a TV star to a movie. But she's terrible in this movie. She's flat. She's lazy, and on set she's a bitch. And that's actually worse than the bad acting. The fact that you take a tight family like Eon, like A&E Productions was, like they've always said they are, in Dan Jack, and be a pain in the ass. That's not their style, you know?
It is a very bizarre casting choice because, like, all right, yeah, it makes sense to be like, all right, who's hot right now? Like, who's you know, a very popular female actress? And they go with Terry Hatcher, who, you know, was Lois Lane for 4 years on, you know, an ABC Superman show. It's just, okay, I kind of get it, you know, kind of keeping within, you know, genre, you know, casting and all that, you know, Lois Lane, you know, let's make Lois Lane a Bond girl. Okay, I can see it. But Yeah, she's sleepwalking through this movie. There's nothing behind any line that she delivers. It's all just very flat, very blah.
Unlikable.
Yeah, she's you know.
You enjoyed her dying.
Yeah, she's in the scene. Oh, I enjoy the scene after she dies because, oh my God, his name just flew out of my head. Dr. Kaufman. Vincent Schiavelli, that's his name.
Oh, Vincent Schiavelli, yeah.
That scene is fantastic. He steals that scene straight out from under Brosnan.
Yes, I agree.
But Terry Hatcher just, you know, they're at the party together and it's like she's just reading the script in front of him. There's nothing behind her performance.
No, she's not good. The action in the movie's good. The climax scene at the end in the water with the sub and all that, that's pretty awesome. The rest of the movie's fine. I actually like this movie. This is probably the one Pierce that I debate people on. I like this movie. Again, I like the Carver character. I love the whole controlling the news, because again, being a news guy that I was for over a decade, I have a soft spot for it. Pierce is good in it. This is his, I don't say his Goldfinger. Goldeneye is his Goldfinger. This is his Goldfinger in the sense that this is the one that he settles into the role itself, which, and he's comfy, in the role now. Judy's M, everybody else is fine. It's pretty much, the women are a little shaky, and that's kind of it, right? The score is good. Oh, the only bad part about the music is the song, which is done by Sheryl Crow, which is kind of flat. It's unspectacular. It's not as bad as the next two. The next two songs are fucking terrible.
Yeah, the whole thing with the song in this movie is interesting because, yeah, they got Sheryl Crow again, who's the hot, you know, recording artist
exactly.
Right now. Yeah, it's not exactly one of the Bond songs I put on when I want to listen to one. The whole thing is, though, the K.D. Lang song Surrender, which plays over the end credits, is the song whose theme you hear throughout the movie. So, like, you listen to the Sheryl Crow song, the Tomorrow Never Dies titled song, and it's like, all right, it's one and done. You don't hear anything about that throughout the rest of the movie. You know, the big brassy thing. You hear that finally at the end. And apparently that was supposed to be the song, and kind of at the last minute they went, you know what, we're going to kind of stick this at the end and do another one. And the K.D. Lang song is far superior.
Mm-hmm. It is. I agree. So this movie also did fairly well. $110 million budget. It's quite more expensive than the first one. $333 million. So it did drop a little bit in revenue. And it was the only one of Pierce's four movies to not open at number one for their weekend. Why? Another movie came out that weekend. I think
with a boat, right?
Yeah, it's a boat and
it's a boat that sinks and
it's got Leo in it, Wolf of something. I don't know. Anyway, of course we're talking about Titanic. It came out the same weekend as Tomorrow Never Dies, so of course it finished number two. On a side note, going back one, I know it's two different people, but she just, what's her name in Titanic just reminded me of Goldeneye, who the, lounge singer is in Goldeneye.
Oh, it's Minnie Driver.
Minnie Driver.
Doing a ridiculous Russian accent.
Yeah, it's terrible, but funny though. I know it has nothing to do with what's her name from Titanic. Why am I blanking? Kate Winslet, thank you. I know it's two different people, but they kind of remind me because they're both British. So anyway, I don't know why I have that comparison, but it just reminded me of that. All right, anyway, so Tomorrow Never Dies, solid, little hiccup here and there. But for the most part, is it at GoldenEye's level? No, but it's not a bad movie.
No, I really enjoy Tomorrow Never Dies. Yeah, when you boil the plot down, all right, what's the plan? Elliot Carver wants to secure broadcast rights in China. Okay, it's a little weak. But it's not about the destination. This movie is definitely about the journey, you know, the performances and all that. This one, this movie has, I think, my favorite cold open in the entire Bond franchise. the terrorist arms bazaar in the undisclosed location,
yes,
which is in like the Himalayas or the Alps or something.
Yeah, I agree.
I love it because it goes between the action on site and what's happening in the control room at MI6, and how it starts with Robinson, played by Colin Salmon, talking to an agent, and it's a one-way conversation. You don't hear who he's talking. He's just referring to White Knight. You know, White Knight. What do you see? You know, this is, and the point that I love is when he starts arguing with him, and again, all you hear is Robinson. He's like, "Yes, I know what it is. You know, it's a plane." And you know, then you just see it cuts to Bond finally, you know, in action. And he's got that killer brown leather jacket. You know, he's got a bomb that's a cigarette lighter. He's just tearing this place up, and then it culminates in this, you know, Top Gun esque fighter jet dogfight. Absolutely love it. Absolutely love the opening to this movie. But as we talked about before, we get some follow through, you know, with the cast, with, you know, Judi Dench is back, Desmond Llewellyn is back, Jodan Baker's back, and this movie also has a scene that kind of makes good on a bit of lacking in the previous movie. A lot of people complain that Bond, you know, gets a new car. You know, this GoldenEye was the start of the three-picture deal with BMW. I mean, we do see Aston Martin. We see the original DB5, which is, you know, always a wonderful thing to see. We see it in both GoldenEye and here in this movie, both briefly. But BMW gets, you know, the contract, you know, he's outfitted with a Z3, you know, you see him driving it, and that's it. It doesn't do a damn thing, despite everything that Q talks about. Oh, there's Stinger missiles behind the headlights, you know, nothing. So with that kind of left on the floor, in this one he gets his BMW 750 sedan, which is just armed to the teeth. And you get a fantastic sequence as he drives from the back seat using his cell phone as the remote, in a parking garage, set to David Arnold's wonderfully titled track, Backseat Driver.
Yes. Yep. So Pierce, for the most part, is 2 for 2. Pretty solid. Then things go a little more haywire. And for the first time in Pierce's run, the future, which is now the present, starts to affect the movies. 2 years later, on November 19th, 1999, we get movie number 3, The World Is Not Enough, which comes from the Bond family coat of arms from the novel On Her Majesty's Secret Service. The film's plot revolves around the assassination of billionaire Sir Robert King by the terrorist Renard, and Bond's subsequent assignment to protect King's daughter Electra, who had previously been held for ransom by Renard. During his assignment, Bond unravels a scheme to increase petroleum prices by triggering a nuclear meltdown in the waters of Istanbul. This is the first Bond film not distributed by United Artists. We are now in the world of MGM, the lion calling the shots now in terms of distribution. Michael Apted directing. So Pierce had 4 movies and 4 different directors. Not the days of John Glenn, Lewis Gilbert, and Guy Hamilton, and Michael and Terrence Young. No, guys bouncing all over the place. We go from Martin Campbell to Roger Spottiswood to Michael Apted. David Arnold's back for the score, thank God. Unfortunately, David Arnold couldn't help the song. The World Is Not Enough.
I like this song.
By Garbage, which is fitting because that's what the song is. Sorry. Aww. Sorry. You and I don't disagree on a ton, but that song is awful. And I like Garbage, and I love Shirley Manson. I love saying her name. And I like Garbage as a band, but that song is terrible. Just my opinion. But what do you like about it?
I just like the song. I think Shirley's voice in that song is just haunting at times. It's this slow, you know, bit to the song. And my favorite part is the guitar riff, which, I mean, you know, it's a small piece of the song, but I really enjoy it. But all in all, I like that one. I like how it sounds, and I like how it works in. It even works in dialogue from the movie, which, you know, you don't see a lot in a lot of the songs.
No,
but, you know, agree to disagree on that one.
No, fair point. I just don't like it. Obviously Pierce is back. Judy's back. We get Robbie back. Robbie Coltrane returns. We don't get Jack Wade. I don't think he's back again.
No, that was it. Two appearances for Joe Don. That's Jack Wade.
Now we get, I like Robert Carlyle, who plays Renard. I think he's a good villain. I like his whole, he's got a bullet in his head, so now he doesn't feel pain. I kind of dig that. I'm not going to lie. That, I think, is kind of cool.
There's your gimmick for this villain.
There's your gimmick for this villain. At least with GoldenEye, we were 2 for 2 with the women. In Toronto Never Dies, we're like 1.25 out of 2, in my opinion, for the women, or maybe 1 for 2. This movie, we are 0 for 2. We could go on a whole thing about Denise Richards, and we'll get to her in a minute. But I want to talk about the one that actually is more disturbing and distressing than Denise Richards, and that is the casting of Sophie Marceau, who plays Elektra. If she was the Bond girl, I would be okay with it, because we've had rookies in that role. The most glaring rookie, who actually is pretty good because it's in my favorite Bond, is Carol Bouquet, who played Melina in For Your Eyes Only. But if you're going to have a Bond girl be the bad guy, you need a woman with chops. And Sophie Marceau has no chops. And she, of course, starts off as a baby face and, of course, turns heel in the middle of the movie. And she's the one that's got to be the one now. And now Carlyle, you know, Renard is her bitch, in essence. And she just has no screen presence at all. At all. And when you are a Bond villain, you need some, particularly if you're a woman. And we've never had that, really. We've had women in the kind of the half villain role, you know, like
Xenia,
and even going back to Sean, what's her name, the redhead in Thunderball?
Fiona Volpe.
Fiona Volpe. Okay, and yes, Irma Bunt and
Secret Service,
Rosa Klebb, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But when you're calling, but they were all henchwomen. But when you're calling the shots, you definitely need to have some acting chops if you're going to be the Bond villain. And this pick is terrible. Terrible. This is more distressing than the Denise Richards casting, which is also equally as horrendous. She's, you want to talk about not delivering lines with any oomph. Terry Hatcher looks like Meryl fucking Streep compared to this. this is abysmal. These two casting choices, and I love Mike and I love Barbara, they should be ashamed of themselves for casting this garbage for two very important roles. You could blow it with a guy Bond villain, because usually you could kind of waggle your way around it. But when the Bond villain's a woman, which is very rare, you got to hit a home run if you're going to take that risk. And you blew it. What are your thoughts on that?
Sophie Marceau, I mean, yeah, this is 1999. And as far as, you know, I think I or any American moviegoer knows, the only thing Sophie Marceau had on her, you know, notch in her belt was Braveheart. Yep. Which was 1995. So we're not exactly in Terry Hatcher territory where, you know, she was hot off the heels of Lois and Clark. You know, we're talking about a 4-year gap here between what really kind of put her on the map and for them to pick her. I'm inclined to agree. It's a very flat performance. Again, I don't know if this can be attributed to her. You know, she's French, so her English speaking, you know, performances were few and far between, but I can't really use that as an excuse because, yeah, she's just this, I hate to repeat myself, but there's just not a lot going on behind those line deliveries and that performance. It's just flat. I mean, yes, she's supposed to be, you know, menacing and like, I'm the villain now, you know, as soon as, you know, that moment happens halfway through the movie, but even when it happens, I don't even remember this was the first Bond movie I saw in the theater. But I remember being excited, you know, it was a big, big spectacle and everything. And the moment where she turns, it was like, oh, okay. So she's the bad guy, but that was about it. Like, it wasn't like she was playing one kind of character for the first half and then all of a sudden it changes, you know, and, you know, she becomes the villain, like the performance changes. No, it was just point A to point B with very little, you know, of a change. Like, yeah, she's a little bit more menacing for the latter half of the movie. But yeah, it's just, it's not good. It's flat.
It's, I mean, it's rough. And you can't, and I'm, again, I'm not being sexist by any stretch. I'm not criticizing them casting a woman as a villain.
Correct. They cast absolutely.
A crappy woman actress as the villain. I'm not saying replace him, her with a guy, not at all. But if you're going to cast a woman to be the villain, not the Bond girl, you could cast crappy Bond girls and get away with it. They've done that many times. But you can't cast a if you're going to take the risk and do it successfully of having a female as a Bond villain, you've got to hit a home run. And Mike and Barbara didn't. Denise Richards, I don't even know what to say. Christmas only comes. I thought Christmas only came once a year.
It's a character. It's a character who was named for one joke.
Yep.
At the Christmas end of the Jones. Movie. Terrible. It is an abysmal performance.
It's awful.
From the moment she appears on screen to the last scene of that movie, there is absolutely nothing redeeming about Denise Richards' performance in this movie. Her line deliveries are atrocious. So you're a British spy. Do you have a name? Oh my God. It's all window dressing because she literally shows up like, all right, she's a nuclear scientist. All right. Now I'm not going to at face value say, I'm not going to believe Denise Richards is a nuclear scientist, because if she had convinced me that she was that character by acting as such, fine. Awesome. I probably would have bought into it. But the fact that she shows up dressed like Lara Croft, which was not by accident.
That's true.
I'm pretty sure they've said that. Yep. It's just right from the get-go, you're like, I can't take this character seriously. Like, and again, I don't want to be like, well, you know, can't you know, an intelligent woman, you know, dress, you know, however she wants. Yes, she can. But when you've got all these factors colliding and not melding at all, that's when it all just breaks down and collapses. Right. I mean, oh, just from the start, you're looking at this going, oh, I have to deal with this for the rest of the movie.
Oh my God. Here's a quote, and Barbara quote. This is a quote. By the way, we got one thing we do have to definitely think about mention here. Neil Purvis and Robert Wade wrote the screenplay. They would eventually write or co-write every Bond between then and now.
Yeah, Purvis and Wade with occasionally a third guy tacked on there. In this case, Bruce Feirstein.
Yes, who did Tomorrow Never Dies. Broccoli was here. Here's a quote. Broccoli was impressed. Barbara was impressed with the writer's suggestion of a female villain, stating that with Elektra, Bond thinks he has found Tracy, but he's really found Blofeld.
Okay, and that's Barbara. A great jumping off point. But they didn't execute it.
But they didn't execute it because they cast it terribly. That'd have been great if you found like someone that's a good bad guy, but she didn't have a clue. The budget went up even more, $135 million, made $361. So, and it was a scoosh over 2 hours.
It also has the longest cold open in the entire franchise.
Yeah, it's like, what, 15 minutes, I think?
Or something like that. It's like 12 or 15 minutes. Yeah, because it starts with him at the bank in Bilbao, Spain. And it was supposed to end with him escaping the bank. But it doesn't really end on an oomph note. And they decided, well, we kind of have to keep going. And then they go into the boat chase, which is spectacular. It's goofy as hell, but it's spectacular. And then, you know, there it is. But yeah, it's the longest.
So anyway, yeah, we shoot ahead. So for the first time after this, we get a little extra time, 3 years between this one and the next one, which was the fourth.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to cut you off. We have to acknowledge one thing that happened in World Is Not Enough.
Yes.
The departure, morbidly coincidentally, in both the movie and in real life.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Of You're Desmond right. Llewellyn.
Yes, Desmond Llewellyn is gone. Yep.
After performing the role of Q in every movie except Live and Let Die from Russia With Love to this one, Desmond Llewellyn was Q. And it's so weird that he exits the role, you know, has his moment, has his exit, to the point where they, you know, introduce his replacement, played by John Cleese, which I thought was brilliant casting. I love John Cleese. I love Monty Python. And then after this has been written, been shot, he dies in a car accident. It's, I don't even know how to describe it, how weird that was.
I agree. It was sad, too.
Well, yeah, obviously, but that goes without saying.
But that goes, yeah, of course. But, I mean, that's just ridiculous and not in a good way. So, farewell, Q. Forget my favorite. I mean, Q has many tremendous lines, zangers to Bond. My favorite one will always be in For Your Eyes Only when he gets into the confessional. And Roger goes, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned." And Q pulls the beard off and goes, "That's putting it mildly, 007. So great. Balls, Q. Bolas, 007. Oh, one great Desmond Llewellyn line after another.
Yeah.
So, yes. But John Cleese replaces him, and we like John Cleese. But, again, to me, he's Monty Python, Fish Called Wanda. But that's okay. At least I like John Cleese. And John Cleese can slide in there and hit some zangers. This is not like, you know, attempting Sophie Marceau. And if we think casting sucked now, wait till we get to this one. We move ahead 3 years to November 22nd, 2002, with the fourth Bond film and the 20th. So we have a milestone here. The 20th in the franchise, Die Another Day.
Insert the audible groan.
Boy. All right. Lee Tomahori directs. So again, as mentioned, four Pierce movies, four different directors. Purvis and Wade back writing. David Arnold back to do the music. And unlike the previous movie where Tech and I respectfully disagree, we can both honestly agree that the Bond song for this movie might be even worse than the one before. I will give you this, sir. If you put a gun to my head and said, either listen to this song or die, it's nice knowing you. I can handle The World Is Not Enough compared to this song by Madonna. This song is terrible. Worse than, I'll say that, worse than World Is Not Enough. Worse. For me, anyway.
Oh, it's bad. It's bad. It's, I will bad. Agree with you on that one.
It's bad.
The song, breaking the streak of, you know, who's the hot recording artist. I mean, granted, she was still making music at this time, but well past her prime. You know, the material girl phase was long overdue. She had since, you know, reinvented herself, what, three or four times, you know, becoming, you know, fancying herself as an English woman at this point.
Yeah,
and they decide, oh, let's get Madonna to do a Bond song. Whew, you're about 20 years too late on that, folks.
Yeah. Oops. Rough. All right.
Maybe here's 15.
So we're off to a great start. Okay. Here's the plot. Bond attempts to locate a mole in British intelligence who betrayed him to North Korea, and a British billionaire who was later revealed to be seemingly connected to a North Korean operative that he fought against in North Korea. North Korea, North Korea, North Korea. Huh? Well, at least we found a new country that could be a bad guy. It is the Bond franchise's 40th anniversary. It includes references to many of the preceding – it says each of the preceding films. Tomahori's – Tomahori's direct. I don't know. I don't think so either. Lee Tomahori's directing was not awful, but all right. Here we go with all of the problems. Number one. For years and years and years, Ken Adam and all of the effects guys, the Derek Meddings and all those guys, did a tremendous job back in the day with models and slick camera shots and, you know, what's his name? I can't think of the guy's name. The skiing camera guy, whatever his name is. Legendary guy, he passed away, but they used him a lot. John Glenn loved him. Like, they were creative in coming up with cool effects, cool designs, you know, Little Nelly and all that kind of stuff. We fast forward to 2002, and these guys are like, what's one thing that Bond fans would love? I get an idea. Let's make a car vanish. Well, how are we going to do that? Easy, just push this button. They looked at a laptop and went, sweet, let's play with this. And instead of actually being innovative and fresh, they were ludicrous. The effects are outrageously illogical. From the car to Bond surfing on an avalanche, or whatever the right surfing on an, was that that movie? Yeah. Surfing on an avalanche or
parasailing or whatever.
Parasailing on a fucking, speaking of a Titanic, on an iceberg or whatever the hell it was. Just utterly ridiculous. They went way, way too far trying to make this movie cute. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, you might regret asking that.
You know what? So, you know what? The counter's rolling. It's all good. So, because we're using a computer. We're not using 1.5-inch tape. But that's okay.
I'm a sophomore in college at this point. It's 2002. It's fall 2002. I am amped for another Bond movie. Like, awesome, Pierce is back. You know, a friend of mine, actually, he worked at a movie theater, and he got me the actual film reel of the trailer, which was a cool little gift. You know, John Cleese is back as like full on as Q this time. Judi Dench is back. I went to the theater, sat down. I'm not even joking. From the second this movie started, Brosnan walks out. You know, the white circle goes across the screen. A gun barrel comes up. Brosnan walks into frame. He turns, he fires, and the fucking bullet comes at the screen, seemingly down the barrel of the gun we've been looking down for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what the hell was that? Did they just shoot? All right, whatever. Movie continues. Bond's in North Korea. All right, that's different, you know, of the time. You know, we're not really dealing with, you know, the Russians or, you know, any of that anymore. Spectre's long been out of the picture. Then Bond gets captured. Bond gets captured. Oh, all right. That's different. That's cool. All right. He's a POW. Interesting. All right. Let's play with this. And then that song starts. What the hell is this? This is terrible. It's also the only opening sequence, I think, to really show the action, like, of the story. It shows Bond, you know, in prison, being tortured. It shows you the progression, because when we come out of the opening credits and the song, you know, however many months have gone by, you know, he's been a prisoner, he's scraggly, and he's got the long beard, long hair. So that's, you know, it's the only real thing you could say about it that's different. And then it just starts to play out with, you know, the North Korea angle kind of subtly disappears, you know, and then there's Toby Stevens, who I like Toby Stevens. He's Maggie Smith's son, so he's got that going for him. I really like him on Lost in Space right now. I did not see Black Sails. I understood he was pretty good on that. But in this, he's a little too, I mean, I'm kind of going to go back on what I said earlier and saying that I really loved Jonathan Pryce being over the top, but that was like fun over the top. This over the top, just, he was like menacing for the sake of being menacing. Like, there was real no reason behind it. Like, oh, he's this, you know, young playboy diamond dealer who's, you know, one of the richest men in the world. All right, whatever. Bond's going up against a businessman with a ice hotel. All right, fine, whatever. And I got really excited when, you know, he comes back to MI6, you know, with the whole thing and that. And to honor the 20th movie, 40th anniversary, Q takes him through, like, the archives. And you see, like, stuff in the other movie. He picks up Rosa Klebb's shoe with the knife in it. You see the Acro Star jet from Octopussy. You see the alligator sub from Octopussy. You know, it's fun. You know, then they roll out the new car. Oh, wow. Aston Martin is back. You know, the three-picture deal with BMW has ended. We're back to Aston Martin. We got the Vanquish, the V12 Vanquish. It's in that silver birch, the classic Bond car color. And then the goddamn thing turns invisible. Oh, we call it the Vanish. Oh, dear Lord. What have they done? You know, we go to the ice hotel. I'm like, cool. You know, that's, you know, a cool Bond villain shtick, you know, cool Ken Adam-esque location. Mm-hmm. All right, we're dealing with another satellite. You know, we've done this. We did it in Diamonds Are Forever. We did it in GoldenEye. We're doing it again. This one just, you know, shoots a big sunbeam at the Earth and melts ice. All right, whatever. The henchman has diamonds in his face. when you're going up against the likes of, you know, Oddjob and Jaws and Red Grant, it kind of falls short in terms of as far as gimmicks go. And then there's the elephant in the room. Oscar winner Halle Berry. Now, I know a lot of people have just, in general, problems with Halle Berry. I don't have a problem with Halle Berry. She's been in plenty of movies that I enjoy. She's done plenty of performances that I've enjoyed. This is not one of them. This is a very blatant case of reactive casting. Who can we get? Even more so than Terry Hatcher and Sophie Marceau. Who's really big right now? Halle Berry. Let's put Halle Berry in a Bond movie. No. This just doesn't work at all. But I was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt, and unfortunately, they took those emotions and threw them into a garbage masher and stomped on them and then lit them on fire, because every line out of her mouth in this movie is a sex pun. I'm hardly exaggerating when I say this. There is no substance to this character. She is purely there to make really bad puns for the entire movie. There is a henchman whose name is Mr. Kill in this movie. They weren't even trying.
Mr. Kill. That's awesome. Hey, they took an L off, so it's not supposed to really be, you know.
Oh, yeah, because that makes it better.
Yeah, I know. The jetpack and Thunderball was in this, too.
That's right. The jetpack.
Jetpack. Yep.
And you know, you've got a car chase. You know, it's the Aston Martin, and then all of a sudden you realize that the villain's Jaguar is also tricked out somehow for some reason with a Gatling gun. You know, so whatever. It's a one-on-one fight. It's cool. The last thing I'll say is I'm not a fan of how this movie is shot, because they use a lot of sped up motion, camera. Cranking, whatever you want to call it, where you'll see like an establishing shot and then the shot will speed up and zoom in real quick for like half a second and you'll resettle on where it was. It's very jarring. It's very of the time, very early 2000s. And it's, like I said, it's jarring and I'm not a fan. It's, you've never seen anything like that in a Bond movie for good reason. You haven't seen it since for good reason. Yeah. Start to finish. I don't throw around the term unwatchable very often. Like I said, I was there to see it when it came out. A couple of years went by. I said, let me give this another try, as I tend to do with most movies that did not leave a good taste in my mouth. Just as bad on second viewing. And that's all I have to say about that.
That's it? Oh, man. Seriously, I put you on these shows so you could talk. My God, that's all you give me? No. Yeah, I mean, the worst part about it is, instead of paying homage, I almost feel like it's an insult when they try to pay homage to the 40th anniversary of Ursula Andress coming out of the Jamaican waters in Dr. No, and instead they have her coming out of the water with her boobs flopping everywhere. This is not what Ursula Andress did. Ursula Andress walked out very elegantly and classily with her little top on, and she walks out like she's in Girls Gone Wild. It's dreadful.
This is the movie where the Bond franchise lost its way.
Big time.
I always cite the Invisible Car as the moment they lost their way.
Yep. Now, Rosamund Pike, who played Samantha Frost here, the double agent. Miranda. I will say this. With the what?
Miranda Frost.
Miranda Frost, I'm sorry. If they had put her in the Sophie Marceau role, I might have actually bought that.
Yes.
She wasn't bad as a mean wench.
I will back that up.
Everybody else in this movie is flat out awful. Even Michael Madsen, who I love.
Michael Madsen is in this movie.
Well, he's what's her name's boss in the
yeah.
NSA.
Yeah, it's not even like, let's bring back Jack Wade from the CIA or Felix Leiter from the CIA. Oh, let's bring in the NSA in this one.
Yeah.
And let's have Michael Madsen as Damien Falco. Hey.
I'm going to give you some quotes before before we go any further. These are quotes from these are real human beings that share oxygen on this planet with us. Although maybe they're oxygen deprived. Michael DeKina, from the site Film Threat. The most satisfying installment in the, of the franchise in recent memory. The best of Pierce's films. A.O. Scott of the New York Times has called this film the number, at the time, the second best Bond film after Spy Who Loved Me.
That is painful to hear.
I wonder if A.O. stands for absolute, well, I can't think of something with an O. Absolute something. I was hoping it would be like AI, like absolute idiot. But so in other words, Mr. Scott, this movie is better than Goldfinger. Okay. Fair enough.
Or for your eyes only.
Anyway. Or for your eyes only. Goodbye. This movie is terrible. It is a train wreck.
Start to finish.
Start to finish, it is atrocious. And you know what's sad? Unlike Diamonds Are Forever, where Sean Connery should take some of the blame for that movie sucking, or Timothy Dalton, who should take some of the blame for License to Kill sucking, I give Pierce zero blame for this movie sucking.
I agree. I absolutely agree. He was given this script, and he had to work with it.
And he has said, and I quote, let's see. Very unhappy. Brosnan, the world's not enough. I had a quote here somewhere. Shortly after the release of Die Another Day, the media began questioning whether or not. No, that wasn't it. There's another line that I got to find it somewhere. Anyway, he knew that this movie was not good. As a matter of fact, the Thomas Crown Affair, which came out after, in between. World is Not Enough and this.
99. So yeah. Same year as World is Not Enough.
Is better than this. Obviously, it's a remake. Still better than this.
Yeah. Yeah, he's actually really good in that movie.
What's that?
He's actually really good in that movie.
He's tremendous in that movie. So is Rene Russo. She's fantastic. Yeah. She's gorgeous in that movie, too.
And just to note, the scene where they are at the party dancing, he is in a tux. And the reason his bow tie is undone is because of the supposed clause in his Bond contract where he was not allowed to appear in a full tuxedo in any production during his Bond tenure.
Ludicrous.
I've heard that for years. I'm pretty sure it's true. I don't know if it is, but I'll go with it.
Obvious. Absolutely tremendous. Oh, my God. So... you know another movie he's good in? And it was right before this came out? Tailor of Panama. With
Jeffrey Rush. I have not seen that movie.
That's a great movie. That's a great movie.
You should watch that. Pierce goes out on a whimper. There's no other way to describe it.
Shortly after the release of Die Another Day, the media began questioning whether or not Brosnan reprised the role for a fifth time. At the time, Pierce was only turning 50. And he looked good. He looked great, actually. Brosnan kept his mind that both fans and critics were very unhappy with Roger playing the role until he was 58. I didn't care because I love Roger. But again, View to a Kill had problems with other casting. It was not Roger's fault. Although those sunglasses in Paris were a little shaky. Anyway, but he was receiving popular support from both critics and the franchise fan base for a fifth installment. I was fine with a fifth. With another Bond with him in it, so long as it didn't suck like this did.
Of course.
Well, not his fault. And he was still kind of young. In October 2004, 2 years later, Brosnan said he considered himself dismissed from the role. Although he had been rumored frequently to still in the running to play 007, he had denied it several times. And in February 2005, he posted on his website he was done. And then in October, well, we'll talk about that in our part five. Brosnan later admitted that he was hurt by the end of his tenure. Barbara and Michael were on the line. We're so sorry. She was crying. Michael was stoic and he said, "You were a great James Bond. Thank you very much." He goes, "I said, thank you very much. Goodbye." That was it. He was utterly shocked and just kicked to the curb. And that actually doesn't surprise me because, Pierce, sadly, was, as I said at the beginning, was Barbara and Michael's first Bond. I mean, let's be honest. Even though he was alive, Cubby was not doing anything during GoldenEye. He was sadly fighting cancer. And as we know, a year later, he would lose. And there are a lot of positives during Pierce's run, but there were a ton of negatives. And a lot of the negatives involved casting. I mean, think about it, Tech. Think of all the great actors that have ever been on a Bond set, from Christopher Lee to Julian Glover to
Judi Dench.
Judi Dench.
Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, Louis Jordan. All those years. Did you ever hear about any bullshit going on set? Never. Two movies in, and you got to deal with Terry Hatcher's bullshit. They may have had the energy and the excitement, but they didn't have their dad's movie sensibility yet. That would change a few years later, which we're going to get to in part five. But Pierce was the victim of dealing with rookies. And his movies would suffer towards the end because of it. And that's sad because he was fine. He was great. And I think Pierce Brosnan should go down as a great Bond who was the victim of some haphazard movie business.
I agree. As we discussed with Timothy Dalton, following Roger, he was kind of dismissed. They're like, oh, well, this isn't the Bond I could bring my kids to see. You know, he was very dour. It was more serious. And, you know, in the hiatus, they kind of went back to the, I guess you'd call it the whimsy that Roger brought. Not so much, you know, goofy gags and winks to the camera, but Pierce had that aspect, that kind of twinkle in his eye aspect to the character. He had that aspect of Roger, but could also be, you know, the serious, you know, action Bond that was Dalton. So he was a really good balance of what had preceded him.
Yes. Yeah. And he had no consistency at the top. I mean, you think about it, Sean had three directors, but he had guys that did multiple movies. And he did six movies. He had three directors, Terrence Young, Guy Hamilton, and once with Lewis Gilbert. Roger had three directors in 12 years. He had one Guy Hamilton, one Lewis Gilbert. No, I'm sorry, two Guy Hamilton. I forgot. Guy did Golden Gun. Two Guy Hamiltons. At least they were back to back. One Lewis Gilbert or two Lewis Gilbert. Two. He did Moonraker.
Yes.
Two, three.
And three. Yeah, John Glenn.
So he had three directors in 7 years, but they were consistent. They were together. And then John Glenn did both of Timothy's. Pierce did four movies and had four directors. That also tells you something. Now, mind you, they're all pretty good. Martin Campbell, Roger Spottiswood, Michael Apted, Lee Tomahori. All good directors.
Martin Campbell, of course, being the standout among them because he would be the one to be brought back.
Correct.
For the next movie.
Correct. So that kind of inconsistency might have also led, because you're talking about four different minds doing four different Bonds.
Mm-hmm. Too.
And when you have a franchise, you need to have a little bit of consistency.
Yeah, the styling is so abrupt. The changes are so abrupt movie to movie, whereas, you know, like we said with Roger, he had two of the same guy, eased into the next two of the same guy, eased into the next three of the same guy. You know, an even progression, kind of. This
you
was
could,
just
right. So, you could tell so that abrupt. You could tell that For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, and View to a Kill were all John Glenn, because they all were his style.
They all had birds flying out.
They all had birds flying, and they all had explosions, and they all had Bond having to kill somebody viciously. All in all, as we wrap up part four, your final opinion on Pierce Brosnan as James Bond?
I really liked Pierce. As you said just now, he got kind of a bum rap. He was handed some questionable material, mainly at the end. But I love GoldenEye. I too will fight for Tomorrow Never Dies, despite its shortcomings. It's a steady decline. It is a steady decline. He starts high, and it's just a slow slide down to rock bottom with only four movies. But yep. I always liked Pierce. Like I said, he brought a really nice balance from what we had seen before to his portrayal of the character. I would have loved to see him continue, would have loved to see a fifth movie because, again, going back to the pendulum was ready to swing with this movie. And it does. It absolutely does with the next movie. And I would have loved to see him, maybe not in the next movie, not that story, because the story that we get required a new Bond. But exactly. Just like I would have liked to seen a third Dalton, I would have definitely liked to have seen a fifth Brosnan, purely based on the fact that their final movies were so on one end of the spectrum that you could almost guarantee what could have come next would have been good. So
tremendous point.
Yeah, it's regrettable that he went out on such a low note. I always liked Pierce.
I as well.
He did. Well, he did get to come back one more time. Going back to the video games one more time, while his likeness was used in Nightfire, his likeness and his vocal performance was used in the game Everything or Nothing, which we brought up previously, which I really enjoy. It's a great game. And
that one I never played.
It's a better final performance for Pierce's Bond. So if you want a fifth one, argument could be made that that's it.
Okay. I'll go with that. Four down, one to go. As we do at the end of every show. Tech, where can everyone find you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Hal Dameron, HALDAMERON, or on Instagram at Technicolor, T3K, NIKOLOR. That's about it. No current presence on Facebook, but you know, if you'd like to give me a follow, please go right ahead. And if you'd like to check out openthefridge.net, that'll direct you to our YouTube page, which holds the majority of our Comic-Con content. We interview a lot of cool people, a lot of actors, a lot of voice actors. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
And of course, you all know where you can find me on Twitter at PTB Podfather. I'm on Instagram. I don't really do much there, so I won't even bother. But I, of course, you can find me on Facebook and, of course, through the various podcast feed and website pages. Thank you for joining us again. Four down, one to go. For Tech, I'm Scott. Enjoy your vodka martini, shaken and not stirred. And please, I'd like to see your car while you're driving it.